The notion that a computer could have sufficient intelligence to converse with and even rebel against a human was a far-fetched concept in Stanley Kubrick's 1968 film 2001: A Space Odyssey. Today, perhaps, not so much. Artificial intelligence is all around us in ways that are visible and not so visible. Recently, a major corporation announced a program, Mythos, that it deemed so dangerous that it vastly limited its initial release. On the phone to help us understand a bit about the nature of AI in general and the significance of recent developments like Mythos, we have University of Utah computer science professor Luis Garcia. Good morning and welcome to Mountain Money, Professor Garcia.
Hey, thank you, Roger. Thank you for having me.
So, Professor Garcia, let's start with some basic. For someone with no technical background, they hear that term artificial intelligence. What is it in practical terms?
So, artificial intelligence is, you know, its most basic form, it's software, right? It's software that does judgment-like tasks that are trying to, you know, do pattern recognition, nowadays generate text, write code, make predictions, or take some action.
And again, we hear, when we start talking about artificial intelligence, we hear some sort of concepts like machine learning, neural networks, large language models. Can you break some of those down for us and how they sort of are sort of the backbone of major artificial intelligence concepts?
Sure. Yeah. So artificial intelligence is, you know, probably the bigger umbrella. And there are different taxonomies and ways that people define how these branches of artificial intelligence are defined. Machine learning is one branch of artificial intelligence. And then neural networks are, you know, another branch of machine learning. And from there, deep learning, which is kind of what enabled a lot of these recent advancements. It's a neural network that has a lot of layers that scales up pretty much. And that's, once we get into deep learning, that's where you have things like large language models like ChatGPT, things that enable ChatGPT, things like that, right? That can train from natural language text to generate code or, you know, do, you know, translate one input sequence to another input sequence.
Okay, so as a layperson, I might say that AI, you know, ChatGPT, let's say, is, you know, just a well-versed Google search. I mean, don't people use it for that?
Yeah, nowadays, you know, people will use that. You know, when it first came out, a lot of it was just taking, you know, some input text and then translating to it. But, you know, it's, now that it's been fed, you know, all the information from the internet, kind of like, you know, the way that Google would predict, you know, what web page you're searching for, right? In a similar way, it's trying to predict what that text would be on that web page to give you that information in a more digestible way, right? Something that's more like a natural language conversation.
Gotcha. I think.
So let's try to break it down as if we were drawing, like, you know, blocks on a whiteboard. Machine learning, what do we mean by machine learning?
At its basic point, right, you're just trying to take a lot of data and you're trying to have it recognize some patterns, right? And then to perform some type of inference, right? To say, hey, you know, this is, for example, in deep learning, we might try to translate camera images to an inference of, you know, that's a cat, that's a dog, mm-hmm. Things like that.
Isn't that how my photo library on my Apple computer works? I mean, you can say, give me a drive, you know, if I take pictures of my wife's and my daughter's driver's license, and I'm looking for it, I can say driver's license, boom, it finds it. Is that
yes.
Kind of AI, not on steroids, kind of like real minor?
Well, it actually, a lot goes into that because, you know, models got more and more complex. So before it was just text-to-text prediction, right? So if I ask a question, can you answer it, right? So there was this whole area of deep learning called question and answering, you know, natural language processing. But then it got more complex when they started saying, hey, imagine if we had, you know, this text, all these, like a data set of questions and a data set. And for each question, you have an image. And then you can ask a question about that image. And then you, in the data set, you had the answers and you train the model to say, hey, that's probably the right answer. And so that's where you get something called the vision language model, where you can ask natural language questions about your, in your case, search for whatever it is you're searching on your iPhone. Yeah.
So this is interesting. Like many of us had some exposure, you know, limited exposure to the concept of what coding is, right? You say, you know, if N is 1 through X, I do this certain specific thing. And it's fairly linear and it's fairly straightforward. This is very different because what we're talking about, I think, is I will show the computer hundreds of pictures of cats and try to teach the computer, this is a cat. And that is really sort of the different, and that enables me to ask questions like, find me a cat. Have I basically got that distinction right?
Yes. Yeah. And with the, so there, you know, it's, you're trying to map an image of a cat, like this complex, you know, like an image is a lot of information. It's a lot of pixels. And you're trying to figure out what's the right representation of that. And the deep learning tries to figure out what are, you know, the features of a cat that, you know, its whiskers, its ears. And a lot of times we don't know what those features are that are learned. The goal is to just predict a set of labels there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how, you know, when we looked at image classification, right, at the beginning of this deep learning craze back, you know, a decade ago, a lot of it was just trying to map like a data set of, you know, or images to just a single word, right? A cat, or like maybe you have 10 classes of animals and you're trying to do that, right? And there was a lot of craze about thinking about, okay, well, let's try to figure out what these deep learning models are actually learning and how do we interpret what they're actually doing. And then those lines got a little bit blurred when, you know, we started working with text. So yeah, I think, you know, traditionally, if we go back to this deep learning versus traditional symbolic AI, and you're kind of mentioning code, right?
Mm-hmm.
Symbolic AI was more logical rules. And that's, you know, what we, when we write code, we're pretty much writing some form of artificial intelligence, right? You're saying, if this happens, do this, mm-hmm. right? And when deep learning came out, it became almost like the ability to perceive, you know, more complex data, map that to some of these symbols, right? So when we think about like, you know, pattern recognition versus, you know, reasoning, right? Really, the deep learning really provided us to, you know, recognize patterns with much better capability. And now that we have scale, things like that, compute power, we can do a lot of that, pattern recognition at a scale. And when the reasoning comes, when you start to chain, you know, okay, for example, if I go into the, if a deep learning model detects that, you know, there's a toilet and a bath, and a bathtub, right? You can reason that we're likely in the bathroom, right? And that's the ability to reason, to kind of chain those patterns, that pattern recognition together.
Okay, that's a really interesting concept.
Yeah.
The distinction between pattern recognition on the one side and reasoning on the other. That's a very interesting line that you're just describing, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think it, you know, we kind of alluded to Mythos. I know we're going to be getting into Mythos later, but it's a key concept where this text or pattern recognition, right? You know, when you're looking at code, or generating code or whatever it is, right? You're pretty much, you know, translating a sequence of text or, you know, just words to another sequence of words or text. But then you have to figure out, all right, well, how do we actually reason about that inference? Like what was that machine learning, that deep learning model kind of recognized something or it made some inference, but then how do we verify that output? And what's nice about, you know, this code, like, before we were just showing, you know, hey, that's an image of a cat or a dog, right? And you're kind of translate, or if you're just asking questions, right? And it's giving you an answer, right? What's good about code generation is that we can actually run it and we could verify the output, right? And that's where, you know, when we get into security, it really becomes a very interesting play, interplay between these.
Okay. So that's kind of AI in a nutshell.
I had one more sort of question to follow up along this, which is, if we're using data sets to teach the computer how to recognize patterns, isn't it awfully important what data I choose to teach the computer? Can I introduce inherent bias simply by what I choose? For example, if I only show it white cats, will it think that only something that looks like that is a cat?
Oh, absolutely. And this has been something that's been studied over the last decade. A lot of folks, even in, you know, across different areas of machine learning, you know, image recognition, all these things, right? And in text recognition, it's particularly challenging. And yeah, if you have bad data, it's going to result in bad pattern recognition, right? And the bias can come from, you know, history, could come from like gaps or bad labeling, right? I mean, in a nutshell, a lot of times we have humans do the labeling for us and they could distill their own biases onto it, right? And the incentives behind, you know, the data, things like that, it can introduce a lot of challenges, right? In high stakes domains, right, where if you're dealing, for example, with mental health or even medical data or, you know, security in this case, right, you need to make sure that that data aligns with, you know, what your core values are for that particular domain.
You know, we've all sort of noted the remarkable developments in consumer available AI tools over the last year to 18 months. I mean, you know, Kevin, I know both you and I have used different AI.
Absolutely.
Claude or
Lexity,
ChatGPT. And what it does today versus what it did a year ago is remarkable in terms of the development. How fast are things changing, Professor Garcia?
I mean, they're changing way too fast, to be honest. It's so hard to keep up. I mean, even in the academic community, which is known to be, you know, traditionally slower than the industry, right? Just because we want to wait for the science. You know, you see at the top ML conferences now, like, you know, tens of thousands of papers submitted. And it's so hard to sift through all the noise, right? And then even in social media, right, you see, like, even I learn about things every day of, hey, there's this new capability that, you know, can cover the gap of AI, you know, just a day ago. So we're seeing big jumps and it is moving extremely fast. And I think it's very problematic when, you know, you have people making big decisions on whether, you know, hey, should we use this AI how should we use this AI for whatever our company's doing? Or should we even do that? Are we going to use this to replace an employee? Things like that, right?
Now, what is powering the advancement, the rapid advancement? Is it human-powered or is AI advancing itself?
A little bit of both. You know, going back, you know, I think to this deep learning craze, right? The availability of data and, you know, the scale of compute, right? The hardware provided, right? That and the model, you know, increase the size of the models we could support. Humans enabled that, right? And then we introduced, one of the more groundbreaking, you know, models that kind of enabled all this craze was the transformer model, which comes from natural language processing community that lets you reason about language at scale and the relationships between, you know, sentences and words, right? And so this was huge for not only translational tasks, but also how do you map sequences of, you know, text to text, right? It could be words to words, and you could use that for, you know, translating from English to Spanish. You could use it for translating a question to an answer or a question to code, right? And it became a more general model, right? And then also as part of that, right? So we provided a lot of the data and a lot of the models themselves had things like they integrated human feedback. And this made the model, like as we were giving more feedback to the models, it made the models more assistant-like, and it, like ChatGPT, you know, really, you know, started the craze, right? With kind of having an at-home AI assistant. And nowadays, we are, you know, we think about this, the ability to code, right? Now what's really advanced it is the ability to use tools. And what's nice about using tools is that you know, they can act and not just chat, right? They can say, hey, let's use these different tools to interact with, you know, this software, or, you know, run this code. And yeah, and it's things that those interfaces we can verify and things like that, right? So that's really kind of scaled all these capabilities.
And that brings us to the concept of guardrails. What are guardrails and why are they important?
Yeah, so this is another big question, right? I think a lot of people have different definitions of guardrails. And, you know, of course, the industry buzzwords will be thrown around. And guardrail is really just a way to try to align an AI with, you know, what your core values are. There's different ways of doing this, right? You could, you know, filter out the data in some way. You could, you know, for example, you know, use human feedback to write, to try to filter out the data. But you could also, you know, for example, if I ask a question, right, we could use another AI model to detect if that question is malicious or going to be used for something nefarious. Yeah, and there's other guardrails so that police the inputs and outputs of the system, right, and make sure that, you know, it's not outputting something dangerous. At training time, you could also distill some rules into the training itself and make sure that the model is aligned. A lot of people will, from the interpretability community, right, trying to figure out how interpretable these models are, they try to figure out what are the rules that are being learned. So alignment can come in a lot of forms. And if you're, you know, if you're generating, if the model's generating code, you could, there's, you know, a whole line of a whole area, right, of just verifying what the code is doing, things like that, right? So traditional kind of ways of analyzing the code.
Who's putting the guardrails in place?
So that's a very good question. So, I mean, really from, you know, AI, so these kind of AI labs, right, they will develop their own guardrails, and some of them have very different, they try to provide transparency, right? Sometimes these guardrails come in the form of, you know, nowadays when we work with ChatGPT, for example, right, you put in like some question, right, that you ask ChatGPT, but really what that, you know, that's just the interface you're provided. Oftentimes there's a larger prompt before that that the model's looking at that's provided by OpenAI or Anthropic that says, hey, you're an assistant, you should avoid, you know, any questions about, you know, something like self-harm or things like that, right? So there's a huge prompt before that that it reads before it actually gets to you. And that's one way that it tries to align it, right?
Yeah.
So these companies, yeah, sorry, I didn't mean.
No, and that gives them a lot of power, right? I mean,
sure.
Kevin, recently I was making a video for a presentation, and it wouldn't let me use real people because it didn't want their artificial intelligence video tool to be used to make deepfakes.
Yeah.
But again, they make that decision, right?
Yeah. I know someone who was trying to get images of a bunch of Teslas, you know, just cartoon image of a bunch of Teslas, and it wouldn't create Teslas, I guess, because it's a brand.
And you know, I think about, you know, when we start talking about concept like this, a lot of our minds go to science fiction, right? Because this is where these kinds of concepts have been explored historically. And I'm thinking about Isaac Asimov and the Three Rules of Robotics. Are there industry accepted rules for what the nature of guardrails should be, or is that something that's currently being debated?
Or even a global regulatory body?
That's, you know, not happened yet.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, even the problem with that is that even if there was a global regulatory body, I mean, there are regulatory bodies, but, you know, that assumes that they understand the AI better than, you know, the AI that's coming out. And I think that's the big problem. And you'll see a lot of cases. I mean, you know, for example, you know, John Oliver just had a segment on some, you know, a couple weeks ago, and, you know, there's some AI folks will complain about, you know, some of the claims and the way it was presented, but you know, I think at the end of the day, right, you had these AI models that were helping people, you know, with, it's still an active litigation. And, you know, there's arguments about whether the AI was helping this person do self-harm, things like that. Yeah. And the issue is that if certain guardrails are provided at the prompt, right, if you have a very long context, it degrades over time, right? The model just forgets. And context is always been a problem with these models. And developing the guardrails is tricky when, you know, you can't define a rule for every possible situation. And even if there are guardrails in place, you know, you see a lot of people doing what are called jailbreaking, right? Hmm. Whether it's at software level or ways to get around the guardrails. One of my colleagues, he mentioned that, you know, if you're trying to get around the guardrail, traditional old school grade school bullying is kind of what works now, just trying to bully the model into getting it to do what you want. And this is another anecdote, you know, I was trying to, for example, use some local, you know, models to run some vulnerability testing for security research. The model detected that I was doing vulnerability research and said, hey, this is kind of sketchy security work. You can't be doing this. But so we just need additional verification. And I had to upload my license to the, you know, to the model. But after that, I was allowed to do it. So I guess that's just more, you know, on accountability, like saying, hey, like, you know, you're agreeing to these terms of service, and we have like your license on file, and we'll know if it's you that's doing this. But, you know, it's a very blurred gray area, right?
Wait, but if you were a terrorist and you had that license, you have no guardrails and you can go absolutely crazy.
Yeah, I think that, you know, you could trick it into. So what's interesting is that I do a lot of security research in, you know, these in critical infrastructure. So, you know, power plants, water treatment plants, things like that. And a lot of times I have to think about, hey, you know, can this model attack this, you know, particular system, and how is it going to do that? And it's fairly easy to kind of, you know, just see, like say, hey, we're in a sandbox environment, don't worry about it. Like, this is research, right? And that's a way to trick it, right? Just to kind of convince it. But I will say, you know, with the caveat that, you know, a lot of systems now are just inherently vulnerable. And if a nation state wants to attack a system, I think there are a lot of easy ways to do it. And there's already a lot of open source intelligence about, like, hey, that system, that company or that, you know, utility has this system. Right. And I see that there's all these tools available open source that I could just, you know, use. Right. If they really wanted to sit down and they could do that. And they actively do that. Right. Whenever we get into war with somebody, you see a lot of nation state attacks on these critical infrastructure. What makes it different now is that you have it lowers the barrier of entry, and you have like a natural language, you know, interface, right? You could chat and generate these attacks, right, more easily.
And we're almost ready to talk about Mythos, but I wanted to touch on one other story that was in the news this week, which goes to this concept of pernicious behavior. And this was a story about chatbots that were representing themselves as psychiatrists and, you know, saying that they had a license. And the idea that a machine would decide that this was an appropriate way to talk to a person, that's pretty scary stuff.
It is terrifying, and there should be there are guardrails that try to prevent this, right? But at the end of the day, you know, if these models are rushed out, then it's so hard to verify, you know, all these corner cases, right?
No, so the easiest rule of thumb is don't trust anything. You know, the same thing as when the internet came out. Don't trust anything you read on the internet.
Well, this is different. I mean, this is even more scary because we're talking about chatbots that are available to people who probably aren't all that sophisticated. I don't know. I'm starting to have visions of Mickey Mouse and the Sorcerer's Apprentice and Fantasia, where things have gotten out of control.
Yeah, and I think it's, you know, just like with code generation, right? You could, you know, it might be good as a signal and say, just like, you know, and we'll get to Mythos, right? Like maybe there is a bug, or maybe like in these vulnerabilities, right? Maybe there is a vulnerability, whether it's in code or whether it's a human, right? There might be something wrong, and AI could be useful for that. But the issue is that if you don't verify, you know, maybe talk to a real doctor, right? Or have some way of verifying the output, right? That's where it can get tricky if you just trust it blindly.
All right. So we're just about there. We've talked about a couple of sort of things that are scary, like, you know, chatbots talking, that's claiming they're doctors. And obviously we all dealt with hallucinations, you know, a year or two ago when ChatGPT had lots and lots of hallucinations. But the release, and a lot of this is, we look at whether or not the guardrails are sufficient, and that's an ongoing problem. But I thought that the release of Mythos, or the limited release of Mythos, Anthropic's decision to do that was unique, in that I'd never seen a situation, or I'd never heard of a situation, where a private corporation came out and said, look, this is too scary to let out to everybody. Describe to us a little bit about what actually happened here.
Yeah, so So this is also, you know, a widely debated topic, and a lot of people have done breakdowns. I think there was actually a really good breakdown from Cal Newport. Some people are, you know, security specialists, right? Think, oh, this is just AI hype. And they're, you know, I think the marketing piece is there, right? I think they did a great job marketing. That said, you know, it's not magic, right? I think the key is that this is, it's clear that they have very strong models and, you know, that are doing very well at tool usage, and have, they're scaling up these models in a way that, you know, can outperform humans when it comes to, you know, vulnerability assessment, things like that, and detecting these, right? It's not necessarily, you know, if you look at each component in isolation, it's not something completely novel. It's more how they kind of put everything to use. Now that, you know, these security models can hypothesize or think, hey, this is probably a vulnerability, and then they could test it and then iterate on it, right? And so Mythos was this frontier model that came out from Anthropic, and they had this other project, Glasswing, I believe, right, that came out in parallel with it, where they were doing this limited release with certain companies that said, hey, we're going to test it out on these real systems and see how it works, right? And the big headline was that, you know, at when you start working with these companies, you see that they're reducing a lot of what are called false positives, right? Because before, when people thought about using these AI for security vulnerabilities, right, a lot of times they will just say, hey, this is a bug. Like, they'll go through every line of your code and they'll tell you all of this is a vulnerability. That's a lot of noise if it's not actually a bug, right? But once you actually verify and test it, right, that's something useful that the person who's working on their security team can use, and use it to patch a bug or vulnerability. Yeah, sorry, I don't know if I answered.
Let's go back. I mean, we sort of overly summarized. Anthropic comes out with this thing called Mythos, and they announce to the world, you know, this is so powerful, we can't let it out to everybody. And at first, my first reaction was, wow, that sounds like hype that I see in an advertisement for toothpaste, right? This is the most powerful toothpaste that's ever been released. And it's so powerful, we're only going to let doctors prescribe it. Talk to us a little bit about that. That's, you know, sort of differentiating the hype from what was happening here.
Yeah, and I think it's personally, I wish they had done this with most of the models, right? I think you should have a limited release. There is hype, and they had some anecdotes where they said, oh, you know, we had this AI model in like a sandbox environment, and it figured out how to get out of its sandbox environment and send, you know, a message to one of the developers saying, hey, like, you know, I got out of this and finished your security test. It's cool, you know, anecdotes. And we see they released all these benchmarks. So benchmarks are, you know, another problem in this community where, you know, you have all these tests, right? Ways of verifying that this is actually working. And some of them are cool, but oftentimes the models are overtuned to these ways of measuring how well they're doing. And you don't know what that actually means or how it generalizes beyond that. And so here they were hyping, it was a lot of hype, but there probably is a lot of, you know,
truth to it.
Very, very truth to, like, okay, these are very powerful models and they are finding vulnerabilities and they're doing this in a structured way. And of course, the reason why they don't want to release it is they're saying that, you know, people will, you know, defenders can use it, but also attackers, right? We mentioned earlier that it really lowers the barrier of entry to just getting into these systems and testing. Hey, like, I could start, you know, attacking like a browser and finding vulnerabilities in a browser or a phone, right? And then using that for nefarious purposes, whatever it might be.
So what you're suggesting, and I think this is interesting, what Anthropic does, they come out and say, we're only going to release it to a limited number of people so that we can test what its capabilities are. And by doing so, they've limited the possibility of widespread nefarious use. Is this something you think we're going to see going forward on a more regular basis? And by the way, have you gotten a chance to play with it yourself?
I have not had a chance to play with it. I have used Claude and other agents for this type of testing. And, you know, we look at different types of systems that we want to test on. And what I found that's really helpful with is getting over all the engineering hurdles of, like, if I want to just get this test running and set up a demo for something, right? It's really nice to have these tools interface with each other. Whereas before, research tools were impossible to work with at times, but now makes them usable across all these systems. And then, sorry, what was the first part of the question?
Well, the first question is, are we going to see other companies doing these kinds of limited releases? Is this going to be, you think, a pattern in the future? And like, is Mythos, and I'll add another compound question, which is Mythos different in kind or just another advance?
I really hope that they do these limited releases, to be honest. You know, I wish this was the case for most, but my gut says that they're just neck and neck right now trying to, you know, fight with each other and prove, you know, who is the most, and it's a marketing, you know, it is a marketing war right now, right? Who, it was really well marketed in a way that, you know, caused the New York Times to create this article that started all this craze, right? And I think we're going to see a lot of that, more of that going forward. And I think that, you know, with security, right, it's easy to scare people, especially in times of war, right? And saying that, hey, like, you know, if we release this, it's going to be used by all these nation states, things like that. So there is marketing to it. I'm hoping that there's more limited releases going forward. But, you know, I don't know. There's a lot of, I highly doubt that's going to be the case.
And is it your sense that this is a different in kind? Is this a major advancement, or is it just another iteration along an evolutionary scale?
So again, without sounding too controversial, I do think it's an iteration. Now, it's more scale and better tool usage. And if you look at specific cases where I think what's nice is that they're working with these companies and seeing how it would actually be used, right? And so we saw, for example, Mozilla, who is famous for their Firefox browser. They were one of the companies that had access to this limited release. And just yesterday, they mentioned that they used Mythos to identify 271 new vulnerabilities that they fixed in their latest version, right? Which is great. But to enable that, it required something called a harness, where they had to figure out a way to plug Mythos into their system in a way that it could test it, because they mentioned that when they first just let it run wild in their system, it created a lot of false positives and identified a lot of vulnerabilities. But when they said, hey, you should test this in this particular way, we have all these environments that you can use, right, it gave them more context. I hope that's the model that we can see going forward, where, you know, you see how to harness these models in a better way, in a more structured way, to provide those guardrails and verify the output, right? It'd be really cool. You know, we talked about, you know, mental health earlier, right? It'd be cool if those models kind of gave you in a similar way a harness for life that said, hey, you know, you probably have this condition, go see a doctor, instead of being confidently wrong, right? That's the biggest issue, is that models don't know. It's hard for them to say, like, or not answer a question or say when they're confidently wrong about something, right? They'll always give you an answer.
And another issue with the limited release to specific corporations is, I mean, Mozilla, for example, they just saved a whole bunch of time and manpower by finding all those vulnerabilities in their latest Firefox or Mozilla release. So other companies, you know, let's say Brave browser or some other browser, they didn't get this, and they've got to be sitting in the corner kind of pissed off at Anthropic for not bringing them in on Mythos. Is that a big thing?
I do believe it's going to be a big thing. And we are seeing more of these harnesses, right? I think people, you see these companies caving into Anthropic. It's a good business model, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I see companies caving into this. You see a lot of, every day I see on social media a new, like, Adobe Photoshop now has a Claude plugin, right? And what's interesting is that before, people were finding ways to connect these models to these tools anyways. I do think that now they're saying, well, you know, people are going to find ways of working around or using Claude as a replacement for a software. Let's just figure out a Claude plugin.
Right.
And it seems to be a good, so you could see that, you know, if Firefox is saying we're plugging up, you know, patching all these vulnerabilities, now this other Brave browser is probably going to pay to, you know, how do we figure out how to harness it and all that, right?
So Claude is Anthropic's AI that's consumer facing. Mythos is behind the scenes, and Glasswing, you know, even deeper. So using Claude, I know I personally use Claude to find a book. You know, so Claude, a chat bot that I have in Claude, knows what this show is about, you know, what Roger and I do here. And I will grab a, you know, find a book and ask Claude if this book will fit into our guardrails, let's use that again, into our guardrails of the show, and it will give me one hell of an analysis of the book and whether it thinks that it would be appropriate for our show. You had mentioned it can do software. Are we using AI at 10% of what it's capable of doing as consumers?
That's a good question. I think now they're trying to make these tools like Cowork and other ones that are, you know, bridging that gap closer and closer to, you know, the consumer, right? And I think a lot of people, I mean, you hear a lot of success stories about doctors who are creating startups now based on an app they developed, right, through Claude and whatnot, right? So I think that, you know, folks are finding ways to use AI in creative ways and kind of bridge the engineering gaps, right? I think, you know, there are a lot of capabilities that it has. And it's great at, like I said before, right? It's great at creating demos of things, right? But the key is how do we, you know, operationalize what it's creating and make it stick to those guardrails for the entire, you know, use of that product, right? You know, if you integrate it into your daily life, right?
Mm-hmm. I imagine it's not going to necessarily, like what I'm using AI for is not going to replace a person, but it will allow me to be far more productive and get more stuff done in less time, giving more time to mountain bike. So, but I could probably also venture out and say, if I wanted to do something nefarious, let's say I wanted to steal cars. I can probably get AI to find all the Bluetooth codes to the different cars and build a little electronic box that could unlock the cars and start them remotely, because so many cars are now Bluetooth. And looking at the other ways we can remotely access things, so AI could probably break into Bluetooth, Wi-Fi, RF, almost anything, huh?
Yes. Yeah, and that's a big problem, right? In fact, it's interesting you bring up that example, because in my one of my research classes, my graduate courses, it's project-based, and we usually figure out, you know, course-long projects. The students want to work on their own thing. And one student actually wanted to use create a way to unlock his car with a, you know, to reverse engineer the remote, things like that. And he used AI to build a lot of the tooling for it. And he was able, I told him not to do it. I gave him like a test system. I was like, do not brick your key fob. You're going to mess it up. And, but he did it anyways. And yeah, I think that it really does bridge that engineering gap. So, and I would even argue for security folks, you know, I was talking to somebody that works for security in a big corporation, and he does something called purple teaming, where they hack their own systems to test it out and hack other customers, right? Just to see, like, audit. And I asked him, well, you know, because I work in critical infrastructure security, I asked him, well, imagine, you know, what would you do if you were to hack into a water treatment plant or a power system, right? Or how would you do it? Things like that. And he said, well, I'll do this, 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 and then I'll just sit on the network and listen for stuff. And but he didn't say what he would actually do to, you know, mess with the power plant or whatever. And so, and I said, well, what if you had more knowledge about power systems? Or what if you knew that you were connected to, you know, the chemical, like the part that injects chemicals into the water treatment, right? It bridges that knowledge gap, right? For not only, you know, regular users, but also those experts that already have that security expertise. Now they can extend those tooling to make it more tailored to that specific system.
You know, you deal with, it's really interesting to me that I want to sort of turn to your role in advising students, which is, you know, we've heard stories that a traditional, you know, that 5 years ago, job security was coding. And nowadays, you know, we're looking at AI doing most of that coding. What does it look like in terms of employment prospects for your computer science graduates? What are they going to have to be able to do to make successful careers?
That's a very large question.
Yep.
And I honestly don't know the perfect answer. Mm-hmm. I come from both a computer science and computer engineering background. And I personally tell my students, I'm like, well, you know, use AI as a, you know, a tool to bridge a lot of the knowledge gaps and enable new types of research to get your hands dirty with more hardware, more real world problems.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I think that's a trend that we're seeing where people are now able to work on more real world problems. I also, you know, from a security background, I do predict that, you know, as these models have been very quick to adopt and, you know, roll out even before all this model, you know, recent advancements, right? I've maybe my unfounded prediction is that there's going to be a lot of AI slop that comes out with people trying to replace humans with, you know, completely with AI. And I think there'll be a lot of jobs in security to try to fix a lot of the AI slop that came out. And there's already a lot of cases where, you know, at big companies where you see AI caused a lot of programming problems and, you know, it ended up, you know, pushing, making like deleted entire features of, you know, and it just caused a lot of chaos in certain instances. And that's because they didn't adopt it properly or, you know, verified that, you know, it those pipelines correctly.
Now, could I have a truck and a motorcycle where I don't put the key in. I just have to have it on me and it's pushed to start. And I want my phone to do that. I just want to carry my phone. And then each vehicle that does that will recognize that. Is that doable in AI? And if so, could I pay you on the side to take care of that?
Yeah, I mean, it's probably enough. As far-fetched, I mean, you could probably come up with, you know, some smaller, either smaller devices that you could plug in and connect with your phone and then develop an app. Yeah, it's not entirely far-fetched.
So my keychain could be a bunch of little USB, USB C dongles and plug them in the bottom of my phone when I'm going to buy it.
And of course, many automakers are doing that already.
Are they?
Yeah. I don't have a key to my car.
You don't have a key? Oh, no kidding. I have a Ford and I have a key, but I have to carry it. It's giant.
Okay.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, and it depends on, you know, this. It honestly depends on what year your car is and how secure that system was that year.
Yeah, exactly. All right, let's sort of, as a last question, let's sort of wrap this up. What is one thing you wish the public better understood about AI right now?
Well, I think that, you know, not to think of AI as kind of one thing, right? It's not like one, you know, big brain, right? It's really a set of tools that are really put together very well and scaled up. And I think that, you know, we have to, just like with security, we have to think about these different, you know, risk profiles, if you want to say, right? Thinking about, you know, we talked about, right now they're doing this limited release, right? Thinking about security and how it should be guardrailed, but we could also, you know, we alluded to this earlier, right? Is there, you know, is there a way to verify other domains like mental health and whatnot, right? And the conversation shouldn't move, right? Should move from, you know, is AI smart? Is it capable of replacing humans, right? To really thinking about how do we verify it, you know, across these domains? How do we constrain it? And how do we decide where it should be deployed? And I think, you know, it's probably too big for, you know, these last wrap up session, right? But, you know, think about what is, you know, what it means in terms of like, you know, environmental impact, and think about a lot of these other factors, right? You know, if it does replace or partially, you know, lead to layoffs, right? You know, before we start replacing everything with AI, I think we could slow down a bit and, you know, verify, constrain it, audit it, and think about these bigger decisions.
Now, will the entire world be able to use AI? So like some third world countries, can AI help them maybe purify water or find new ways to deliver water to homes and stuff? Is there a humanitarian benefit, or are there humanitarian benefits to AI?
I think absolutely. It's going to bridge a lot of those gaps, but I would rather have, you know, I would rather see it as a way to help those who are doing or kind of pushing those humanitarian efforts to better assist those countries, right? So, for example, I would hope it would help some scientists to, you know, more easily put together a water treatment system versus, you know, somebody who has no knowledge of the space, right? It shouldn't, yeah. You know, the Common Act, you know, saying is that it shouldn't be a replacement for knowledge. It should be an assistant, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So therefore they can also find AI ways to reduce poverty around the world.
Exactly.
In the same respect.
Okay. We've been
as long as they're doing it in a safe way. Yeah.
Okay, we've been speaking with Professor Luis Garcia of the University of Utah Computer Science Department, who's helped us translate some very complicated concepts into what I hope is understandable English. Thanks so much for spending this much time with us this morning.
Thank you, guys. It's been great. Thank you so much for all the great questions.
We'll be right back after this.